Good morning. So last time we talked about MNAP, just this idea that we could take a file and say, I want to make this part of my memory. And this was useful in particular for loading programs, that loading a program is copying the program into particular places in memory. You want some of those parts to be writable for like global variables, but not to be modify the original file. We want some of them to just be readables for like code. And this was a good match. And Unix-like operating systems tend to take this a step further and say that we're just going to consider what a process's memory is as just a list of these mappings. And obviously not all of your program's memory is part of a file, or was originally part of a file. So we're gonna say that some of these mappings don't have an underlying file, but you still have a region of memory that you've allocated, which just, we're gonna make up a file if we need one, and otherwise we won't. And some of it will have an underlying file. And they support both what they call shared mappings, which are that if you modify that region of memory, you actually get changes to the file. And private mappings, which act like your initialized global variables, where it's as if we made a copy, but we actually do copy and write. That we don't make the copy until we absolutely need to, which we learned was a trick for fork. It's also a trick for loading programs with like global variables. If you never change the global variables, why do we change? We can just keep a copy of the same thing we'd use if we read that file with your executable. And from this view, we viewed memory as a cache. That for these mappings which represent files, that we have cache parts of the file. We have this both for things that were part of our program's memory, so we want them in memory most of the time, but we want to eventually be able to free up memory if we're low on memory. And if we know that, hey, this part of your memory is the same as the contents of the file, we can just get rid of it. If we need it later, we can get it back. And we'll also use the same cache to make things like read faster. When you're reading a file, if you've read it recently, we'll have a copy cached in the operating system's memory, and that's the same copy you'd get with MMAP. We'll also use memory as a cache for things which don't have files. And the way that works is that we just choose a location on disk when we need one. So we say, you didn't specify a file, that's okay, I'll make one up for you just in case. And whenever I'm low on space, and I say, oh, you haven't used this part of your heap for a while, I'll just write it to disk, hope you don't need it, but if you do, I can read it back from disk and you'll just notice your program's really slow. So to implement this memory as a cache concept, we needed some data structures. And one of them we've seen before, that was the page table itself. Because the processor, when we're accessing our memory, needs to find out where that memory actually is, if it's a hit, if it's actually in memory. And the page table is exactly the data structure for that, and since the processor is doing the work, the OS doesn't get to decide what the page table look up, the processor decides because it's reading it. We also need, in the case where it's not in the page table, to be able to find the data and load it. And this is something the OS does. The OS gets a page fault when there's nothing in the page table, and the OS decides how to handle the page fault, so it's going to have a data structure where it can say, oh, you're accessing that address, let me look up what I told you was allocated there, and make it actually work. So if we know that you map that to a file, I'm going to look up, okay, what file was that, what part of the file, and I'll do the read for you to load it into your memory. Or if it doesn't correspond to a file, say, oh, I told you that was normal memory, but I actually moved that to disk because we were low in space. Let me look up location I moved it to disk. And that's another data structure the OS needs to maintain. So these are the most obvious ones because they sort of directly are on the path of how do I satisfy an operation where I'm trying to access something? How do I find that thing? But we also had cases where we needed the reverse mapping. And this came up when we were doing replacement, that we ran out of space, we need to get rid of something, and getting rid of something means writing it to disk. Writing it to disk means that we better know where everything that's pointing to it in memory is, so we can repoint that to disk. So for things like file mappings, we need to say, yeah, this cache part of the file, not there anymore. For things that are in the page tables, we need to say, that page table entry invalid, it's not part of that file anymore. If you try to read from that, you're gonna get something new. Like, you're gonna get this new stack page I allocated for a program I'm running, not part of that text file. So we needed to have a reverse mapping. And this turns out to be often quite complicated in real OSs. So we went over sort of a high-level overview of what Linux's solution was. And they have this data structure for physical page. And this is something pretty much every OS does. There's variation in the rest of the details, but you have to have information for a physical page because that's typically what you'll be tracking. So what's some way of saying, this is a physical page, where is it used? So in Linux, the form that takes, if it's part of a file, they have a pointer to the file, and then they go backwards from the file to say, who's using this file, where are they using this file, and you figure it out from that. And for data which isn't part of a file, which might not have a location on disk yet, because we haven't had to write it to disk, they have a linked list of here are the programs which are using it. So you can find all the copies of it in a page table. So you can remove them when you're getting rid of the map. So any questions about these data structures and this general idea of memory as a cache? Which I know is quite complicated because I made, when I figured out how do I review this, I realized that will last long. Yeah. Is the data structure for
like the Linux solution?
Is this data structure a tree? So it depends how you look at things. So there's different cases. So the cases for an underlying file is we have a bunch of pages, and the page might point to a file, and the file has a list of pointers to the mappings, which are, remember, the things we've mapped, that list table we saw for each program. And each of these mappings has sort of a start and an end and a pointer to an actual process, the equivalent of a struct proc in Linux. So you could kind of look at this as a tree because we have this sort of branching here, but it's not really a tree. In the case of the list of mappings, we have our page. It points to a linked list, basically. So this is the page, and these are the linked list items. And each of these point to a mapping, is basically how it works. And we make separate linked lists whenever we make a new linked list when we fork, because we now have a case where some things are shared between the parent and child, and some things are only in the parent, some things are only in the child. So we make new lists as we need it. Based on every time we fork, we have a separate list for the parent, for the child, and for things that are shared between the parent and the child. So that doesn't really look like a tree. And I'm sorry, I can't write, apparently. So these are linked list items here, and this is the actual same page, data structure representing a physical page. Other questions? So the topic we started after that was, well, we talked about the mechanics of page replacement, that when we replace a page, we're going to need to say, okay, so this here is the page I'm replacing. So I need to go find it's all its mappings, go to the process, find the page table for each process, figure out where it is, and remove that entry. That the mechanics are we need to find out every place this page is used and get rid of it. But a question we need to ask is, how do we figure out what page do we get rid of? So we know if we've chosen a page, how we get rid of it. We look for every place it's used and eliminate it from all those page tables and other data structures, like the list of pages for a file, like for doing reads. But how do we actually figure out, the victim page? How do we do this first step here of finding a victim page to evict? And we talked about sort of our conflicting goals here, that we have hit rate and throughput, which are almost the same thing. That if you have the highest hit rate, that is, you have the least times for loading things from disk because you tried to access something and it wasn't there, or creating something, that you'll do best. We also care, and that's almost the same as throughput. That's probably going to maximize performance because it's very expensive to read things from disk and have your process wait while we're doing that. And so that's what we'll care about next. And I mentioned as an aside that that's not quite the same thing. So we're going to start by optimizing for hit rate. And we're going to make an assumption not only that we're optimizing for hit rate. So we care about hit rate. We're going to assume that's going to get us the best performance, even though it might not. And the classic case where it might not is that if we have to, in order to replace a page, write it back to disk before we load the new thing, well, that might be slow. The other assumption is that we're only going to bring in pages on demand. So we're not going to read in advance. So something we'll talk about a bit later is that, well, you could do better than what I'm talking about here if you predicted the future really well and said, oh, you're probably going to access this whole file. I'll just read it now, rather than waiting for you to start accessing it. But we're not going to do that yet. So we're going to say, I'm only going to load as late as I need to, but I'm going to use a very magical algorithm to start out with, which is the best possible algorithm if you have these constraints. And this is called Belady's Min. And the idea is that when we need to replace a page, we'll take a look at each page, and we'll take the page which is accessed furthest in the future. So this is a little difficult to implement because you need to know the future. So we don't do that. So obviously we aren't actually implementing this on a typical system. You'd have to look at the program and figure out what are we going to access later, which you can't do. But this is useful to think about because this is, as I said, the best possible algorithm, assuming you aren't proactive. Assuming all you do is bring in pages when you need to. So let's look at what this looks like. And the way I'm going to have this is I have a list of reference pages. And in these examples, to keep things simple, I'm going to say we have three physical pages. We have three places to put things, and we have four things we're accessing. So basically, almost the simplest possible case of doing page replacement we could think of. Just one extra thing I want to store, don't worry about it. So I'm accessing page D here, and it's not one of the ones I loaded. So originally we accessed A, I loaded that, we accessed B, I loaded that, we accessed C, I loaded that, then we accessed A and B, that was great. No problem. What do I do to get D in memory? So we're trying to access D, I need to get D in memory, how do I do that? So who thinks I should replace A, B, C? Okay, so everyone agrees C, and the reasoning is that C is accessed furthest in the future. C is also accessed the least recently, but that's not what we're looking at. We're saying A is accessed next. I better not replace A. B is accessed in 3 time units, 1, 2, 3. C is accessed in 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. C is the winner. C accessed least recently, that's the one we should actually replace. So we do that, and we have a bunch of A's. We access A, that's still around. We access D, that's still around. We access B, that's still around. Both A and B were still around because we correctly chose, based on our prophetic knowledge of the future, that, oh, those are the things you're accessing soonest. I better not replace them. So, okay, so now I'm accessing C again. Which thing do I replace? Someone have an answer? Yeah. Tie between A and D. So, yes. So, and what's the reasoning for that?
They both aren't accessed again.
So. Yeah. So they both aren't accessed again. So A is accessed, we'll call this infinity time units away. B is accessed in 1 time unit. D is accessed in infinity time units. By our rule, we can choose either of them. In this example, I've chosen A, but I could have equally have chosen D, and we'd have the same performance. So does this idea make sense? Okay, so we obviously can't actually predict the future. We can't look at the programs and figure out what they're gonna do in our OS in order to implement belayed easement. So what we're gonna do instead, typically, is we're gonna look for common patterns. And we want ways of looking for patterns that are pretty efficient, where if we know what the pattern is, we have some nice way of actually using that information. So we're going to talk about 2 different models of usage of stuff we're going to access repeatedly, one of which applies more to operating systems, the other of which applies to other cases where you want to do similar caching things. So one model of program behavior is called working sets. And the idea of a working set is that we assume that at any time a program is using some stuff that's a subset of its memory. It has some functions it's running, it has some variables and global data structures and arrays that those functions are using, and that's the part of memory the program's using, and that's called its working set. And while it's using that, our assumption is, well, there might be other stuff in the program's memory, but it's inactive right now. It doesn't really need it. And our goal in page replacement should be that we want to keep the working set in memory because we know it's going to be used, and everything outside of the working set we're telling is inactive, so we can get rid of that. So our intuition with this model is that we somehow want to figure out what's in the working set and never choose that as the thing to replace. Always choose something else. And working sets are a thing which has empirical support. One way we can see this is that if you simulate processor caches of varying size with a least recently used like replacement policy, you see these distinctive marks depending on the program you're on. So this is someone ran a whole bunch of benchmarks, and the benchmarks use memory differently. But we see that there's these distinctive places where there's an amount of memory they need, which gives them good performance. Higher is better here, or higher is worse, sorry. So we're saying, for example, for this program, once they get up to this size label WS1, that they have a very good, this is a miss rate, that their miss rate gets almost to the minimum by that, and you have another point here where their miss rate gets to the real minimum. And a way of thinking about this is that this program has a working set which is this size. And if you can store that much information, you can make sure that it stays in memory for the most part. And it has a second sort of arguable working set, which is this size. And if you store that much information, you keep really a short term memory. The reason we see two probably is either because the program has different times when it's using different amounts of memory, or because it uses some amount of memory if you look at a short amount of time, and some bigger amount of memory if you look at a longer period of time. But we see this sort of behavior with a lot of programs. You can see, you know, this program has this size where this is the amount of stuff you really need to cache, and maybe you can get some benefit by going up to here, but that's the amount of size which is active. And this is empirically. And these people figure this out by running a simulation with a cache which tries to keep recently used things. So they're measuring how much recently used stuff do we need to keep around in order for the program to only be using the stuff we're keeping around, basically. So, and we can see that this happens naturally for a lot of programs, and it's hard to come up with a program where you don't see this naturally. And this both comes from this intuition that if you have a function running, you're using that function and its variables and not much else, and you're probably using those things a lot, and from this empirical data. So any questions on this model? Okay. And so as I said, if you want to take advantage of this information, you want to just give each program its working set. You want to figure out what things are in the working set. You want to keep those in memory. You never want to replace them if you're low in memory. And if you want to run as many programs as possible, you don't want to give programs much more. As long as every program has its working set, it should run well, and that's going to maximize how many programs you can run. So the replacement policy is you identify working sets by some magic, and you do it. And that's what you do. Okay. So, some caveats about the working set model. So when I talked about working sets, I said that there's a subset that's active, and I'm saying, you know, because we're running a certain function. But programs don't always run the same function. So what happens when we change between working sets? When we're changing what function we're running? Yeah. So you're saying we're going to have to replace a bunch of things because the working set changed. Yeah. And this comes up empirically too, which is another evidence for kind of the working set model. That when a program changes what it's doing, we see what's known as a phase change. That the program goes from one phase to the other, and this has a spike of cache misses. It has a spike of cache misses because now we're conceptually bringing in the stuff for the new phase, and we can get rid of the stuff for the old phase. And this is normal behavior. So if we're tracking working sets, we want to track working sets even though they're going to change over time, and we're going to have to pay a cost when we change between them if we don't have everything in memory. And we can see evidence of phases if we look at real program behavior. So this is a graph of a lot of things, not of all of which are caches. So this line, and this line are all cache miss rates for different caches. And from that, you can see where the program changes phase. That we have these big spikes in cache miss rates where we're changing what data we're using. There's also some more direct evidence that the program is changing what it's doing in some of these other lines. So here is instructions per cycle. So you can see we're running different kinds of instructions during these little spikes here, which take up a different amount of time to run per instruction and use a different amount of, this is energy here, different amount of energy. And have different branch prediction rates, which is this line here. But this is something which happens. So this is gzip. So can someone guess what might be happening or that this is what gzip looks like?
Like
What might GZIP be doing? So GZIP is a compression program. Yeah. So you're saying switching from one file to the other. So that's a good theory, and that might look like this. And it's kind of related to that, but this is all one big file. But it's related issue. Some other theory? So what I believe, sorry, and yeah.
Is it like compressing the writing what it has to
Yeah, so you're saying it's compressing some stuff, writing what has a disk, and compressing some more. So I believe it's similar to that. So I believe GZIP works in blocks. So I believe it's processing a block, and then it's turning that block into something to write to the output file, and then processing the next block. I believe that's what's happening here. So it has a phase where it processes like a couple megabytes of data, and then it turns that into the stuff it writes to disk and processes the next couple megabytes. I believe that what's happening. And phases happen a little less clearly in some other programs. So here's GCC. You see we have these big spikes where we're changing the part of the compilation we're doing the same thing. So working set is not a static thing. So if you want to actually estimate it, you need to deal with these changes. You need to deal with that we're changing from one thing to another, and you want to probably adapt pretty quickly and not, you know, get left behind thinking, oh, we're running in this region here. I'm going to ignore whatever stuff we're accessing to actually write out this chunk to the compressed file. So the typical way we're going to estimate working set is we're going to hope we're not in the middle of a phase change, in which case there's not much we can do, and we're going to look at what we used recently. And the idea is what we used recently is going to be stuff from the current phase. We're not going to look too far back in history, so we don't look at things that are not the function we're running now. And you can use this to estimate the working set. So our idea then is that we can split memory into part of the working set or not based on this estimate. And you can take advantage of this. And the classic proposal is that if there's not enough space for all the working sets, you just stop the program. And the reason for this is that we know the program really wants the working set. That if it's not in memory, that's going to have really bad performance. So rather than having the program have bad performance now, we're just going to stop it and run it when we have more space. And this is a real thing that some OSs, which when you aren't your typical consumer or server OSs, have done. Our typical consumer OSs don't do it because you would be very annoyed if you started up Word and it said, well, it would run slow, so I'm just not running Word for you. But there's other contexts where this is a reasonable idea. But as far as a replacement policy, it gives us a natural thing. Take from the least recently used stuff that's not part of any working set, or at least closest to not being part of any working set, if we assume that programs are following this model. So if they aren't, we're in trouble. Right. If the program actually doesn't have a small list of stuff that's active, but it like reads everything once, then reads everything once again over a giant piece of memory, that's not the working set model. We're not going to do the right thing. But assuming we have the working set model, that's what we should do. So this is, if you remember when we talked about caching in like 3330, and maybe briefly in 2150, this is the locality idea. This is temporal locality in particular, that things accessed now will be accessed again soon. And we have our intuition for it, which is this working set, explains why we believe that will happen. So we can't do Blaise's min, but we can do some real policies, and one of them is least recently used. So this policy at least doesn't require us to predict the future. We're just looking at the past. We can actually know the past. We can just observe it. So we'll do least recently used. So here I have this access pattern here. I want to do least recently used. What should I replace? Thinks it's A for putting in D. B. C. Okay, so there's good agreement there. So we replace D, and we're not looking forwards this time, we're looking backwards. We're saying A was accessed 2 time units ago, B was accessed 1, C was accessed 3, 3 is furthest ago, that's the one I replace. So, how about here? What do I replace? So who thinks it's A, B, C, D? Okay, so in fact it is A because we used A the longest ago. So in this case, we happen to get the same result as Belady's min, but we're doing different reasoning. We're not looking forwards, we're looking backwards. We're saying, how long ago was each of these things used? We take the one that's longest ago, we assume we can forget about that and no one will notice. So least recently used, though, it's not the optimal policy. So there's cases where it really breaks down. So here is one of them. So we're accessing D, and when I access D, I look back in time and I say, oh, A was least recently used, C was used last time, then B, then A. A is least recently used, I'm going to replace that. Then we access A. I say, oh, D was used last, then C, then B. B is least recently used, I replace that, and so on. Yes? So the question is, how would you actually find the least recently used page? Like, how would you implement this? So we're going to talk about that more. And the problem is, of course, how do you collect this information? If, like, the process called you every time it ran a page, this would be relatively easy. You just keep the list, or something like the list. And for some things, that's practical. Like, so if we're doing this for read system calls, we can actually keep the list. But if we're doing this for memory accesses, we have a bit of a problem because the processor doesn't tell us when the process accesses things. We'll talk about solutions for that. It turns out the solutions will mean this will not be the policy we're implementing, but something related. And notably that this worst case for least recently used, you see here, even if we implement it correctly, is way, way worse than me. And something which may annoy you about this worst case is that this is actually pretty plausible access pattern. Like, you can imagine programs where you want to just scan over something over and over again that's slightly bigger than your memory. Well, that works out really badly with least recently used. So, since you're all least recently used, let's go through this probably quickly. So, what should I? So, someone want to walk? So, I should. I'm gonna fill up this memory. So, I bring in A. I bring in B. A is a hit. Then I bring in D. Now what happens? Where do I put D? C. Yeah. You place B. And why B and not A?
B is the least recently used.
So because we used A here. Yeah. C. Now where do I put B? And A. Here, because now A is the least recently used. We have 1, 2, 3. D is a hit. BSA hit, CSA hit, DSA hit. Where do I put A? In B, because we have 1, 2, 3. So everyone, so it seems like simulating this policy, not a problem for people. Okay, so that's at least recently used. Okay, so we'll talk about implementing that in a bit. First, a bit of an interlude on other models of how people access data. So we have this working set model, which said that there's a specific amount of stuff that's being used, everything else isn't. And that's good for programs. But there are other common uses of caches where we're going to want a different model. So one example is, let's say you're running Wikipedia. Wikipedia has a lot of web pages, which you want to serve quickly. And this is something that Wikipedia uses as a cache. Wikipedia, in fact, has several clusters, one in the US, one in Europe, and one in Asia, that are just caches for web pages. And they want to figure out what to cache. And you want to figure out what's a good model for that. It's not the working set model. There's not a subset of Wikipedia which you're looking at and everything else you're not. People are not. Like, people are always looking at all parts of Wikipedia at different frequencies. And you can look at the empirical data. So Wikipedia helpfully has page view statistics for download. So this is 1 hour from October 1st. This is a log plot, where here is we're saying that the top ranked page was viewed a little over 10 to the fifth times. The second page was viewed about, you know, 3 times 10 to the 4th times, and so on. Going down here, the 10th ranked page was viewed a little over 10 to the third times in the sample, and so on. And say the 1,000th ranked page was viewed a little over 100 times. So does this graph make sense? Yeah. Can I talk about the steps? So what are the steps here? So this 10 to the 0 is 1. So this line is 1, this line is 2, this line is 3, and so on. So because we can't have 1.5 page views, it's become a step, like back down there. And we have, notably, like a whole, like, tens of thousands of pages with exactly one view in this hour, which is typical. So something to note about the overall shape of this graph is that we have this distinctive straight line for most of the graph. The top is a bit different, and this is known as a ZIF distribution. So there's a mathematical formula which gives you this line, and this is what it looks like. And this is typically what you empirically see when you look at things like web page hit rates, usage of words and languages, and things like that, that you get this natural curve of popularity from accesses. And this is not like the working set model, because boy do we have a lot of things which are accessed but not very much. It's not the case we have this sharp drop off. We always have more stuff that's being accessed all the time. And also, because this is a log-log scale, we have a few items at the top which are way, way more popular than everything else. And this applies no matter what we consider the top. We can say the top 1 is way more popular than everything else, the top 10 is way more popular than everything else, the top 100, the top 1,000, the top 10,000. You know, every time we look at that, we say it's more popular than everything else, which means that we have an advantage no matter how big we make our cache, and it's kind of diminishing, but we still have an advantage. It's not like working sets where we say, once it's big enough, we've done everything. It's not what this looks like. So a few items much more popular than others, and what's commonly called the long tail. That we have a lot of items which are accessed a very small number of times. but it doesn't go down to zero. And we can keep going and getting these down to one. So helpfully, good strategies for caching a zip distribution is basically the same. You want to keep the most popular things. Typically, in a practical situation, you want to look at recently popular things, because what's popular changes. That even though it follows that distribution, like news comes up and one Wikipedia article becomes much more popular and things fade out of popularity and so on. So you want to look at kind of recent stuff, what's most popular. Unlike the working set model, you're not going to have this notion that there's going to be some cutoff beyond which you don't care. Like, there's always benefit to caching more stuff if you have the space. That's a real benefit. It's not like it's never going to be accessed. And LRU does okay, and in fact, as far as I can tell, is the policy Wikipedia uses for their caches. There might be some alternative policies that make more sense if you know you have a zip distribution. So one example that's commonly proposed is least frequently used. That we know frequency is probably a better, more predictive than recency, because we know we have that sharp difference in frequency, and we know that if we see some random thing which just accessed, the actual most likely case is that it's something down here. And you know, that's not actually not something we should take as a signal. We really want to know if it's accessed a couple times, then we know it's probably higher up and more useful to cache. But at least recently it still does okay, because yes, we're gonna cache that stuff down there probably more than we should, but we'll quickly learn, oh, it's not being accessed, and it will fade out of our cache. It will become the oldest thing after a while. So it doesn't do too bad. But you might imagine alternate policy of least frequently used or least frequently used, where you like have some notion of, I only look at recent stuff, so at least if something becomes massively popular all of a sudden, I figure it out. And don't like say, oh, that was never accessed in the last month, so it must not be important, and it's like the article for the presidential election in November. You don't want to do that. So questions on this? Yeah. Why do you use that strategy? So if we have a zip distribution, caching all the stuff up here is going to help. So all the stuff up here is accessed like over 100 times. And the sort of assumption with the zip distribution is that knowing something was just accessed isn't what we want to know. It's we want to know that something is popular. So frequency of use better measures popularity than recency of use. They both do. But frequency is probably a better measure. Frequency in a recent time, like you know, last hour or something like that, is probably a better measure of popularity than recency of use, because we have a lot of things from down here which may have been used recently, but it's just kind of a coincidence. Does that make sense? But recently used still does pretty well, and in fact well enough that it seems like no one's complaining about using it. Because the really popular stuff is also going to be used recently all the time because it's accessed enough. Okay. So that's my interlude into alternate distributions. So for OSs, we mostly don't care about this because usually we're assuming we're running programs which look more like working sets. But all this stuff we're doing for managing caches in OSs is similar to what you might do for managing caches for like a web server. So let's talk about implementing LRU, finally. So you want to implement LRU in software. So what we'll do is we'll maintain a doubly linked list of pages. And when a page is accessed, we remove it and add it to the head. So the head of the list is the least recently is the most recently used. The tail of the list is the least recently used. So I probably should draw this. So we have our linked list, which is doubly linked, so we can remove things from the middle. And we have our had, which is most recently used, and we have our tail, which is least recently used. Whenever we access something, we move it to the head. And whenever something goes off the tail, that's what we take. We take from the tail, that's the least recently used thing. So this policy, if I wasn't talking about physical pages, but I was like talking about files in like a web server, you could implement this directly. You could have a linked list of all the files that you have in memory, and you could move things in the linked list every time someone gets it. And this is in fact what web caches do. But when we're talking about pages, it gets trickier because I have this thing here which is run some code every time a page is accessed. And boy, are pages accessed a lot, because how often do you read from your stack, your heap? All the time, like every other instruction. And we want to make that page fault, because that's the mechanism the processor gives us for you access memory, I get to run. And that will make everything really slow. So how do we do that, if we want to do it? And we'll talk about how slow it is when we talk about how we're doing it, because it's even slower than it might sound. So we make every page invalid, but we need the access to actually happen, right? We get a page fault, we mark it as most recently used, we want it to happen, but we want to detect when you access it the next time, so you want it to be invalid after we do this access. So there is a way of doing this that you could really implement on x86. That would be one way of doing this, and that's that, you know, your debugger has this step function. There's hardware support to implement that. On x86, there's this thing called the TF flag, or trap flag, which will run one instruction and then trigger an interrupt, or an exception. So the OS can set this flag, go return from the page fault handler, then it's going to get another exception, and then it can mark the page as invalid again so it can detect the next access to the page, which we have to do, otherwise we're just detecting one access and then knowing the others, and that won't tell if this is the most recently used thing. So this is something you could implement, but we're doing two exceptions per memory access plus changing the page table, which turns out that we need to invalidate a TLB entry. This is not great. And it's really, really slow. Yeah. So it's not just a page fault in every access, it's two faults in every access. It's really, really slow. This is not something you want to do. In fact, this is probably not even the fastest way of doing this. The fastest way of doing this probably involves taking the machine code and like compiling it to new machine code, even though that sounds incredibly annoying to do and really slow. It's probably faster than this, and also like 5x slower than just running the program without doing this tracking. So what can we actually do? And our solution is that, well, we can't track every access, and we're gonna live with that. We're gonna not implement LRU because we can't track every access. We're gonna implement something else that isn't as good. And our intuition is that we don't need to actually know what was accessed most recently. We just need to know, was this accessed kind of recently? We don't need to know that we have that this was first, second, third, fourth, that in a real system we have like 10,000 pages. We just want to know that you're not in the top 1,000. Like that's enough information to make sure that we're not making a really bad choice. And that's what we want to avoid. We want to avoid making really bad choices. So we just want to know, was this access kind of recently, like in the top 500, you know, top half of the pages or not? And to do that, we don't need to detect all accesses. We only need to detect one of the recent ones, one of the ones you know, that puts it in the top 5,000 of our 10,000 pages. And we can use the same trick to detect accesses, but we don't have to worry about detecting future things. So you mark a page as invalid. And when we get a page fault, we just say, oh, I marked that as invalid, not because it was wrong, but because I wanted to remember if there was an access. And in that case, we just mark it as accessed. And we can do even better. So it turns out that hardware has support for this in hardware. So there's a bit in page table entries that's sometimes called referenced or accessed, which the hardware will set for you whenever the page is accessed. So you set it access bit to zero, and when the hardware actually uses that page table entry, it sets it to one for you. And this is something x86 does. So there's an access bit, so you clear it. Later on, you see, did it become one? If so, it was accessed. So regardless of whether we're using hardware to do this or setting the page invalid and using software, we have a way of saying, from some time I started looking to some future time, was the page accessed? And this is the mechanism we're going to use to implement our policy. So we'll start detecting accesses on the pages, and if we don't see any accesses a little later, we know it's not recently accessed. We know that there's this time window where that page wasn't accessed. And that's enough for our not accessed recently policy. This idea makes sense? So let's go through a real policy that you can implement this way. So here, I have a policy called second chance. So I'm going to have all my physical pages in an ordered list, like I did for least recently used, but it's not going to be a list for most to least recently used because I can't actually implement that. But it's going to be an ordered list. When I allocate a page, I put it at the top of the list. And the intuition is that if I just allocated a page, it's used, I don't want to take it soon, I'm going to take pages from the bottom of the list. So minimally, these pages have been around for long enough to, from the time I started using them, to get to the bottom of the list. So that's our first approximation of not recently used. We know at least that it's not used in the sense I didn't load it recently. That I'm not going to replace a page I just loaded. So a page gets to the bottom of this list. And if we're going to say, okay, so I have this candidate page which has been around for a while, it's been loaded for a while, and I say, was this actually accessed? And if the answer is yes, I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to give you another chance to get to the bottom of the list before I actually use you. I'm going to put it to the top of the list, just like it's a new page that's fresh, with the reference bit clear. And if it makes it to the bottom of the list without being referenced, then I'm going to actually use it and replace that page. So the idea is that every page gets a second chance. It goes through the list once, then we give it a second chance to go through the list without being accessed. And only if a page can make it all the way through the list without being accessed, from top to bottom, do we actually replace it. And how fast we go through this list, well, it depends on how many times we need to replace pages. So if we're allocating a lot of memory, we'll go through this list quickly. If we're not allocating much memory, we'll go through this list slowly. So this idea makes sense. So let's go through an example here of what this looks like. I have dashes here, which are that, in this case, I'm access D, and I have to do a bunch of work before I actually figure out where to put the page for D. So we're starting off with a list which looks like we have empty memory, so we have our pages. In this case, we have one, which I'm labeling as NR for not referenced, then 2, which I'm labeling as NR for not reference, then 3. So this is our initial state. And then we access A, and what we're going to do is we're going to take from the bottom of the list, we're going to say, is this referenced? So we see 1, and it's not referenced, so we're going to allocate that, and we're going to move it to the top of the list, and I have it labeled as referenced here, because presumably immediately after we load it, the program actually accesses it and sets that reference bit for us. And the same thing happens with B, and then C. Then we access D, and we have to do a bunch of work. So what happens here is I look here and I say, oh, I have 1, but it's referenced, so I'm going to give it a second chance. I'm saying I would allocate 1 at the bottom of the list, but it was referenced, so I'm going to move it to the top of the list, but clear its reference bit. So now I have 1 not referenced at the top of the list. I do the same thing with 2. I see I have 2 here, 2 is referenced, I'm going to move it to the top of the list, mark it as not referenced. I have 3 at the bottom of the list, it's referenced, I'm going to move it to the top of the list, mark it as not referenced. And now 1, it got its second chance. We put it at the top of the list as not referenced, it had a chance to be referenced, but there's nothing happening, we just had to take care of D, got all the way to the bottom of the list, and it still wasn't referenced, because nothing happened. We have to use the whole list. So finally, we replace 1, use 1 to load D. So, whoops, okay, that was not what I meant to do. And I see why that fit. I should have remembered his line number. So that's what we replace there. So the later cases, if I... Yeah, here. So... So we replace D. Then we access B, that's a hit. Then we access A, and we look at the bottom of our list. We see we have 2 here, which was just accessed by B, so this reference bit is set. So we say, okay, 2 gets a second chance, so I put it at the top of the list, mark it as not referenced. And then I look at the next thing on the list, and that's 3, and 3 was not referenced from the time I put it at the top of the list here to as not referenced, so I actually replace 3. And it immediately gets referenced because we're trying to access A. Then I have something similar with C. So C, I look at the bottom of the list, I have 1, but it's referenced recently, so referenced since it got onto the list. So with D, so I move it to the top of the list, then I take the next thing, which is 2, which wasn't referenced, so I replace that. So this makes sense? Yeah. Questions? Okay. So this is the mechanics of that. So note that in the worst case, the way this policy works is we take the thing at the bottom of the list, and we go through the entire list, giving something a second chance, and we find out, well, everything on the list was referenced, so we end up just reverting to taking that first thing anyways. But we end up clearing all these reference bits. So this is the second chance policy. This is probably simplest LRU approximation, and it turns out it actually does pretty well. So it's pretty easy to implement. We just need this single detective it was referenced ever. And in this case, we're only doing things when pages actually need to be allocated. So we don't need to add a timer or something like that. And it works pretty well. And it's, in fact, pretty similar to what Linux does. Linux does a bit of a refinement of this. So Linux has a similar policy, but it involves 2 lists instead of 1. So Linux has an active list and an inactive list. And pages start on the active list. And the assumption is anything on the active list is not what we want to replace. And we wait for pages to start at the top of the active list and to make their way all the way to the bottom of the active list. And we're guessing that when something gets to the bottom of the active list, that maybe we're not actually using it. But we'd like to test that hypothesis. So the way we're going to test that hypothesis is that we're going to move it to the inactive list and we're going to mark it as invalid. So here we're going to mark invalid. It's typically what we'll do. And then, because we marked it invalid, if it's ever accessed, we'll get a page fault. And when we get a page fault, we just move it back to the top of the active list. And if something makes it to the bottom of the inactive list, well, we know that it survived that time on the inactive list without ever being touched, and that's what we take. And this is the actual policy that Linux uses. So it's very similar to second chance, but rather than using the whole list, having things go through the whole list, we just have this subset of the list of pages that they go through and get a chance to not be accessed. And this was chosen because they don't want to scan giant list of pages if you have 16 gigs of RAM. So the purpose of the intuition here is that this inactive list is sort of limited size and slash, and you can configure the size to change its performance. And if you want to scan through less pages at the cost of not having as good an LRU approximation, you can change the size of the inactive list to do that. So, questions on this policy? So, a tricky thing in this policy is how big is the inactive list? And so Linux just makes an arbitrary choice. I think they choose not bigger than half of memory, something like that. But that's a choice you have to make with this policy, and what choice you make changes sort of how well this policy works. And I've deliberately not said exactly when do we move things to the inactive list. I don't actually know the answer, but I'm not sure it's just because of page allocations. Okay. And we saw these two policies, and they rely on this idea that for over some period of time, we look at, is this page actually accessed? And that period of time, in the case of our second chance policy, was decided purely based on when we needed pages. Here it's basically that sort of thing. We could also, you imagine, rather than having the second chance policy, we move something to the top of the list and set it as not referenced when we need to allocate a page. We could periodically unset the reference bits or something like that. And this gives us to sort of another common view policies, that we just have an ordered list of pages, and if we want a more general policy, we just track the last times these pages got through the list, were they referenced in that run through the list. And this is commonly known as clock, and I'll show a picture of why you might call this clock. But the idea is every once in a while, it could be when we need a new page, it could be just every so many milliseconds, we take a page from the bottom of this list, check if it was referenced this run through, record that information, move it to the top. We can keep as much history as we want, and we can use this to make our decision. And so we can have an arbitrarily close approximation of LRU by doing this. As you saw with the Linux example, even though you can get arbitrarily close, they don't find it worthwhile to do much more than one or two reference bits worth of approximation, basically. And the other view of this is that we have our pages arranged in a circle, and we have this hand of a clock that's sweeping around, recording, was it referenced since we last got there. that's where the name comes from, that this view of this algorithm. So questions, ideas. So this is the generalization. So with this general idea, like, you can record all sorts of information and you can implement fancier and fancier policies that are closer and closer to real LRU. But it turns out that most OSs like keep basically 1 or 2 bits worth of extra information per page. Okay. So that's page replacement that approximates LRU, which we learned from the working set or ZIF model is basically what we want to do. Now, when I started out when talking about the ladies min, I made a few assumptions, and one of them was that we only replace on demand, that we're only allocating a page when we need to, and it looks like we're potentially even doing a bunch of work, like with a second chance policy, like we have to iterate through this potentially big list to allocate pages. Real OSs are more proactive. So far, we never actually do anything until memory is full. And that's not actually great. So can someone think of one reason why that's not great? And as a hint, think of files. So I told you we cache files in memory. Why is this policy not great for files? It's a problem. We only get rid of pages from memory. We keep things in memory until we absolutely need to get rid of them. We never actually do any, you know, write anything to disk unless we need to. Yeah?
Do you ever read the file? Does it affect this going block by block?
So if you have a really big file, does it affect what?
Like, would you evict something that you access from random files?
So the question is, if I have a really big file, I'm gonna evict parts of the file for it, potentially. Whether that's a problem depends on how we're accessing the file. We'll actually get to that problem in a bit, probably next time. So there's something else. So when we evict something, if it's dirty, we write it back. And it turns out that that's not actually what you want to do. So if I unplug my desktop, how much data should I lose? Like, should I lose a minute of data? Should I lose like 10 hours? How much data would you expect me to lose? Yeah?
Around
10 minutes. But, and that's right. That's like what sort of thing you expect from an OS, that if you save files, like, you might lose a few minutes of stuff, but you'll have most of your files there if you lose power. But that doesn't really work so well. Because my desktop has a lot of memory, and relative to like the size of files I'm working with, and let's say I never run out of memory, then I'm never going to write anything back if we have this just lazy strategy that we only write things and evict pages when we need to. And that would be really bad, because then I could potentially lose like days of data, because there's over the entire time I never ran out of memory. So real OSs aren't satisfied with that, so they do some extra work. So they periodically scan for dirty bits and do write back for that reason. That you don't want it to be the case that you lose data, so they try to make sure that, at least for files, that what's on disk is kind of up to date, even though there's no reason to write that back to disk. Because you'd be really annoyed if you could save a file, but then your machine loses power like 5 hours later and you lose that data. And that's exactly what would happen if they didn't do this. So the other thing is that so far we've been saying that when you access a page and we need to load it, then we evict the stuff. Real OSs might be a little more proactive than that. So one reason for this is that evicting things takes time. So you might have to write something back if it's dirty, And even if you don't, you need to clear out the page. You don't want it to be the case that when you access some heap memory, you see some confidential data of another user. And to ensure that, OSs need to zero out the memory. So it's common for OSs to kind of evict in advance and have a little pool of memory to get new pages that's already like pre-zeroed out and cleared, and where everything is evicted, like all the page table entries for it are already invalid, so they don't need to worry about doing that work when you access the page. And you can do this in the background, hopefully when other things aren't running. When other things, you know, don't have work to do anyways on like an interactive system. So you can just maintain a small number of pre-zero pages, basically, that are already removed from page tables and all that. Okay. So that's some brief notes on like why we don't do the lazy replacement. We'll talk later about being even more proactive. I'm going to start by talking about so the case where LRU performs poorly. Who can describe for me qualitatively that example I gave where LRU was really bad? What were we doing? Or can describe another example case where LRU would be really bad? So there are real case things that we do in programs where LRU is really bad. Yes. Okay, yeah. So one case where LRU doesn't do the right thing is where a working set is bigger than our cache size. Now, unfortunately, in that case, there's not really much we can do. But we could do better than what LRU did there. So there's another common type of case where LRU is really bad, which is not what we saw earlier. But I'd also like to talk about this pretty common, that you can probably think of. And as a hint, this is something which happens more with files than with normal memory in your program. Yeah?
So like you're just looking at a new thing every time?
So you're looking at a new thing every time. Yeah. So why would this happen?
Because then you have to keep replacing, right?
Okay, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so you're looking at a new thing every time. So and there's one particular thing that we commonly do where we look at a new thing every time, and that's we read a file once and then we're done with it. So if you like think of playing back a video, like we read through the whole video from end to end, we don't reread the video over and over again. And the LRU policy says, gosh, you just accessed that video, better keep it around for you. Even though it's pretty unlikely we want to keep that whole video in memory that we're reading. Or if you think of a text editor, the text editor loads it into memory, it reads the file once, it doesn't actually access it over and over again. So these are two cases, and we saw the second one, that LRU example was example, we had a large amount of data that we were scanning over and over again, so we did have multiple uses, but it was too big for our memory, and LRU wasn't the right thing, and if we're only reading things once, LRU isn't the right thing. And it turns out that these patterns are common enough that Linux does something different for file pages because of them. It does something which is deliberately not LRU for file pages to try to detect these patterns and not do LRU for them. And then we'll start with that next time.